Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, Connor Rebush. We are here once again talking about this week's UFC card going down in Las Vegas, Nevada, headlined by a woman's flyweight bout, Amanda Ribush, Rose Namajunas. We're talking about the prelims right now, though, with a featured prelim between Trey Ogden and Kurt Hollibaugh. Yeah, and there are some okay fights on this prelim card. If the whole card didn't look exactly like this, it could be. It would be fine, you know.
Yeah, I'll say right now, just in case our listeners, as if they're not already inured to our just relentless depressive attitude. Next week's card looks a lot better, up and down. So, like, they are still capable, and I think it's also an Apex card.
It is not. That is why.
Well, there you go.
It
that explains
Atlantic
it.
City.
That explains that is, everything.
Yes. That is why it has both like, a main event and a co-main event.
Yeah. And then, like, three or four fights underneath that.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of these are just fine.
Yeah. Apex is the don't care, didn't try. Beating heart of the UFC.
Yeah, and beating is really in question.
Yes.
The sluggishly twitching heart of the decrepit, ossified UFC.
But our featured prelim bout, Trey Ogden, Kurt Hollibaugh. I mean,
how happy were you when Kurt Hollibaugh finally got a UFC win?
I was very pleased.
I was happy for him, too.
Hollibaugh is one of our guys in not like an extreme case, because we both know that he's not like actually going to ever be.
Well, a lot of my guys, I don't think are ever going to be a champion or something.
Well, no, but nothing like that. But I mean, even in the UFC for very long is the Hollibaugh case. Like, I don't think he's going to stick around even.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know that I can have that much room in my heart for Hollibaugh, because I'm not going to be watching him in LFA or, you know, Titan FC or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Kurt, but that's just the way it is.
I don't have the attention span.
Yeah. But he is a recklessly violent man who knows how to do fun things and always makes his fights fun. And I will always respect him for that.
He is a blast.
And he is fighting a guy who is no fun at all.
Yeah.
But I am grudgingly learning to respect in Trey Ogden.
Trey Ogden's good in a very limited way.
Oh man, who was the Scottish? Stevie Ray.
Stevie Ray.
He is Stevie Ray 2.0. Maybe not the athlete that Stevie Ray was, but a much more a much less awkwardly schooled fighter than Stevie Ray was.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Trey Ogden is kind of who I thought that other guy was. Who was the guy who has a jab and literally that's it?
Oh yeah. The bantamweight.
And I picked him like twice, and you were like, Connor, you're an idiot. And then he just lost really badly twice. Whoever that
Johnny
guy was.
Johnny Munoz.
That's right, Johnny Munoz. Yeah, Trey Ogden's kind of who I thought he was. He is you will never see Trey Ogden, at least up to now, I have never seen Trey Ogden lose a fight in the UFC because of like some big catastrophic error.
Yeah.
I've seen him lose fights because he doesn't try hard enough to win.
Yeah, he's a fighter that if his opponent has one weird trick that they can go to every time over and over, he will just let that happen. He will just not solve it. Like, Jordan Leavitt basically calf kicked him.
That's what I mean. Like, he can go in there. He has a win over Daniel Zellhuber, which has aged quite well.
Yeah.
You know, I think he has gotten better since then, but also like that's a dangerous and determined fighter who tends to get better as the fight goes on.
Yes.
But then he also lost to Jordan Leavitt.
Yes.
Who is like nobody's idea of a consistent or potent fighter.
Yeah.
And he just could not because he doesn't want to do anything except maintain the distance and either be all the way in or all the way out.
Mm-hmm.
And Jordan Leavitt had one tool when he was all the way out that he just couldn't figure out.
Yep.
One that happened to work against the jab, which is basically all Trey Ogden wants to do at long range.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. He just couldn't win.
Yep. And yet at the same time, he absolutely, absolutely crushed and wiped the floor with my boy Nicholas Mata.
Yes, he did.
Because Mata has no range game at all and has to step through middle distance to make anything happen.
Yep.
And he just ate the jab every single time to the point that he got so frustrated that even Trey Ogden could start picking him off with heavy shots and takedowns.
Yep. Yeah, I think ideally that is what Trey Ogden would like to do, is sort of do a slightly more wrestling heavy Machida thing where he just frustrates you and annoys you at long range until your only way to get to him is by taking a huge risk.
Yep.
He can counterpunch, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is fully capable of being a problem fighter for a lot of guys. It's just he's the kind of fighter who could probably on the right night take out somebody like Drew Dober for like a split decision win.
Also lose to Patty Pimblett.
or lose to Jordan Leavitt, you know.
Exactly,
He will always, it'll be somebody capable of winning or losing to anybody from the bottom to the border of the top 15 on a given night. Dez Green was that kind of dude, too.
Absolutely, yes.
This is the thing with the neutralizer, and we've seen it, or Bantamweight with Chris Gutierrez, same kind of thing.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
These fighters are very capable of beating good competition and losing to really not good competition.
Yeah, mediocre competition, let's say.
Yeah, mediocre competition.
Very, very ripe for stylistic exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think this is actually a pretty interesting matchup because Kurt Hollibaugh is definitely going to eat a lot of those jabs.
Oh, yeah. All of them.
He's definitely going to run into some counters. But he's not going to accept it. I don't think it's not going to neutralize him.
Hollibaugh does not know how to accept a fight. Like, he does not know how to be, like, comfortable with anything, any fight. Yeah. Whether he's winning or losing or whatever, Hollibaugh is always pushing for something more.
Yeah.
Always.
He is a pathologically aggressive fighter.
Yes.
And I think that's what it takes to get a fun fight out of Trey Ogden. One where both Trey Ogden will be able to shine and might also wind up in trouble because there's a certain level of aggression where it just Trey Ogden is like. I've been watching watching that show Shogun, Zane.
I need to see that. Pretty good.
Cool. Consistently very interesting and entertaining and well acted through four or five episodes. Definitely recommended. And, you know, there's a point in there where this happens in a lot of this kind of political intrigue fiction where the clever protagonist will trap his political enemies in some rule of procedure. You're like, actually, you can't impeach me because you need the full council and I resign from the council.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't actually impeach me. Because you don't have quorum.
Yeah.
And Trey Ogden is one of those counselors.
Mm-hmm.
Trey Ogden's like, he's stuck in the rules.
Yes.
Right? There's a certain way you're supposed to, like, respect my jab and my distance management. And Kurt Hollibaugh is like a ravaging barbarian from the northern wastes who's just gonna be like, the rules are fake. Only power exists.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not saying Trey Ogden might not outclass him, but I think Trey Ogden is going to be in for a few very unpleasant surprises when Kurt Hollibaugh just does not respect the sort of a staid fight that Ogden is trying to enforce with his neutralizing game.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be said, too, that Kurt Hollibaugh is a nearly impossible fighter to knock out as well. Yeah. And in fact, generally to finish, he got armbarred by Shane Burgos and he got knocked out by Hani Barcelos in a fight that if you've not seen it, you should go see.
You should watch a lot of Kurt Hollibaugh fights, but that is a blast. Yeah. That one.
That one is, it is an awesome fight. But otherwise throughout his whole career, he has otherwise, he's never been finished.
Yep. That's actually pretty impressive given how insane he is as a fighter.
Yeah. As a relentlessly aggressive fighter who always puts himself in danger. He's only been finished twice. And it was, one was an absolute war and the other was just a insane comeback. Like Burgos was rocked.
He dropped Burgos and then went into his guard and got instantly submitted.
Yeah.
If he'd had like another second to settle in, it probably wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
It's just that it happened the moment he was trying to finish the guy he just knocked down.
Yeah. So it is, that does make this fight especially chancy for Ogden, because if you've got somebody relentlessly aggressive in front of you as a neutralizer who does not get finished and does not get deterred.
Doesn't really get neutralized. Like you, yeah. I think you have to be a more, there's like the ideas are there for Ogden, but this is what I mean is that he's sort of like, he sort of fights as if you are required to respect it. Like you're not going to be okay with getting jabbed, right?
Yeah.
And some guys just are. Mm-hmm. And when that's the case, you got to kind of double up on that jab and you're going to have to put some meaningful shots behind it. I think he is capable of that. And I think he'll probably get pushed to the point where he has to.
Yeah, there may be an instructive thing. It was years ago, so we can't take everything away from it. But Kurt Hollibaugh does have a split decision win over Des Green.
Hey.
So there is maybe a instructiveness to that kind of fight where...
Hey.
It was, I'm sure, an incredibly close run thing. And I would not be surprised if this is an incredibly close run thing.
Right.
Like that fight he had against Austin Hubbard that he won by submission. That was
close.
That was close. And Hubbard doesn't know that he should be a neutralizer because he wants to believe that he can be a powerful fighter.
Yeah.
But he is at heart at his best as a neutralizing fighter.
And he was able to neutralize Hollibaugh through most of the first round.
Yeah.
Just that Hollibaugh just kept extending the combinations and Hubbard couldn't help but try to hang in the pocket landing combos of his own when he probably should have just kept making Hollibaugh reset and jabbing him.
Yep.
Yeah. But then you also have, so those are like two somewhat neutralizer types that Hollibaugh has beaten.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have the fight with like Thiago Moises.
Yeah, where he just got out wrestled easily. He just overextended every time and Moises just ducked under and
he got nailed on the counter.
And he got nailed on the counter too.
And Moises is like an anti-positional fighter.
Yeah. He's not even a neutralizer. He doesn't know how.
He doesn't even have the jab of a neutralizer. He doesn't have any way of grabbing initiative and like bringing out the counters. He just waits and times you.
Yep.
And Hollibaugh could not. In the same way that Ogden just like couldn't come up with an answer to the calf kick of leave it. Hollibaugh against somebody who's just stands there and counters. It's almost like a hard matchup for him because he's like, counter me.
Like, yeah. He lost Andre Harrison too. And Harrison is like the grindiest of grinders. Just super slow paced, super unambitious as a fighter.
So I think Ogden's somewhat untapped counterpuncher potential might be called on in this fight. And again, I think he does actually have some solid counterpunching when he feels he has to throw, when somebody steps into his range. He did against Mata and it did it really well. And also the wrestling is going to be something that Hollibaugh is just going to be dashing into.
Yeah.
Again and again, and overextending and off balancing himself. I am going to take Ogden, but I think it will probably get really dicey in the middle.
Well, I had been willing to take Ogden because I figured you'd take Hollibaugh, but I'll go ahead and
do it.
Switch it up and pick Hollibaugh.
Ogden's not a fighter to get excited about, but there's a certain style matchup where I just know he's going to get pushed. I actually think this might be a fun fight from both guys.
Yeah, yeah. I think if I have a worry here for Ogden, it's that he is not athlete enough to hold Holabaugh down in the way that would best suit him staying in front of this fight.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that Holabaugh can otherwise press him enough of the rest of the time to steal away rounds with bigger shots. So I'll take Holabaugh for the hell of it, but Ogden is probably the smarter pick. It's just, it's a good fight, you know?
I like it, honestly.
Yeah.
It's rare that I say that about a Trey Ogden fight. He's usually pretty boring.
But we like Holabaugh and we trust him.
Holabaugh gets a fun fight out of everybody he fights.
Let's be honest. He's just one of those dudes.
Thiago Moises has some dog shit fights too, and his fight with Holabaugh was not boring.
Lot of Chris Lieben and Kurt Holabaugh.
Yeah.
You know?
He's not quite as, you know what, I'm gonna do him a credit. He's not as sloppy as Chris Lieben.
No. He's a 2.0, but like I'm just talking about
He's got the spirit of Chris Lieben.
Yeah, that spirit of like there was never a not fun Chris Lieben fight. You know?
Yeah.
Holabaugh opened at +117, is currently at +132. And Ogden opened at -129, is currently at -147.
Kurt Holabaugh, by the way, another guy, he should never, ever be cut from the UFC.
No, he really shouldn't. Like I say, I feel unfortunate that, like, I don't think he will. I think they will cut him. He's 37.
You just got to know how to use him. Like,
yeah.
Kurt Holabaugh as a quadruple A action fighter. This is the dude for Apex cards, honestly.
Yeah.
You're going to have your cards where you're just like, okay, we're bringing in some guy off the contender series. Holabaugh's your promotional gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's your first test for a young prospect. Like, Holabaugh is perfect for that role, and he's always fun. Like,
yep.
He should have a career in the UFC for as long as he wants it, really, because he never disappoints.
Yep. Yeah.
Even if he rarely wins at this level, he never disappoints. He's always fun.
Yeah. The UFC really does. I mean, I'm glad that they are allowing so many more fighters to stick around, but they really do need to kind of like figure out what they're doing with their talent more. You know, they just have like this big mess that they're just kind of mashing together.
Yeah, the matchmaking. We said this last week. It just feels thoughtless.
Yeah.
Who's available?
All right. That brings us to a featherweight bout. Ricardo Ramos, Julian Arosa. And another fight. Too. Yeah, another fight with solid potential for as long as it may last. It is a really hard fight to call because Julian Arosa is, I mean, he is, if we talked about on the main card, Vivi Yusuf Zalal as a absolute quadruple A fighter, Julian Arosa is the quadruple A fighter. He is Mr. Quadruple A, which is especially to say he has a very functional, aggressive MMA game that has major gaps in it and is unfortunately coupled with him not being durable.
Yeah.
And it's just exactly suited wrong for sustained success at a high level.
Yeah, but he's such a good quadruple A fighter that he actually like,
he can go on runs. Yeah.
He's been on some runs in the UFC a couple.
Yeah. Yeah. He can win some bigger fights than he should. It's just, you know, he is the kind of fighter that is or would be pretty like forever a champion outside the UFC in smaller promotions.
Sure. Yeah.
And not a champion, not anywhere close in the UFC.
No, never.
And the big thing, of course, too, with him is that if he doesn't get hurt and put away immediately, he's actually often really quite tough to beat.
So I was going to say, it's not even just across the board a lack of durability. He gets caught cold.
Yeah, he's a cold starter. And he is one of many, as we talked about with Kennedy Nzechukwu over on the bonus of our main card, Vivi. One of many fighters that should fight long, but only fights tall.
Yeah.
And that is bad news when you are a cold starter, because you are always trying to fight on the inside. Like, you're always stepping in and exposing yourself to damage.
Yeah. He's like, once he gets into the fight, then he's drunk driving.
Mm-hmm.
He can get into a million car accidents, and he's just like too relaxed for it to hurt him, you know?
Yeah. Especially if he can get and stay on the front foot.
Absolutely.
Because Rosa loves to, he will bounce in and out of the pocket. His big problem has always been that he gets into a really set rhythm and he bounces into the pocket and without anything in front of it, without any kind of setup offense, looking to create a tight little combo inside. And guys just detonate him as he's bouncing forward and it just crushes him.
Yeah.
But if you see him in fights where that doesn't happen and he gets to be on the front foot and do that where he's just constantly pushing forward like that, he becomes an avalanche of momentum. Like, just
he is a bona fide swarmer when he gets going.
Yeah. Will turn it on you all fight. And that makes this Ricardo Hamosh fight really interesting, because Hamosh is very much a fighter also at his best when he's coming forward.
Yeah.
And not nearly as driven to do so as somebody like Erosa.
Yeah.
Hamosh can really easily be confused out at distance and pushed back.
Hamosh is kind of basically, in the aggregate, he's like a quadruple A. Like, he would be a regional champion as well.
Mm.
But for different reasons. Because, like, his physical ceiling is pretty clearly just higher than Erosa's.
Yep.
But his game is a disorganized mess.
Yeah. He is a fighter that loves, like, exciting
trick shots. He loves trick shots. Yeah.
Loves the back fist. Loves a, like, wheel kick. Can throw a really nice tight 1-2. Can hit a really good, fancy upper body lock trip and scramble through with it.
He's got to be the only guy in the UFC with two spinning elbow knockouts.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right? He's got to be the only guy.
But he also can just, and even in his grappling, where he should seem like a much more, like, you know, he should be in that sort of Charles Oliveira zone. He's kind of like, his grappling is kind of like old school Charles Oliveira.
Yeah.
Without quite as much venom, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was like, oh, you might be dead, or you might just power through it and Charles Oliveira might be dead. You know, when Oliveira kind of had the quitter tag on him.
Mm-hmm.
And Hamosh is definitely very much that guy, where it's like, oh, you can see him hit a really slick takedown, or a slick trip takedown from the body lock into back control and be on somebody. And then they'll like roll through and land a shot, and suddenly he'll just be like stuck and frozen.
Yep.
And like Lerone Murphy really put it on him that way.
Yeah. And he is also, as we saw against Charles Rodin, a guy who will just blindly walk into the same counter.
Yeah.
Whether it's in grappling or striking, again and again, he's just really a guy who's like stuck in a couple patterns and very situational ideas.
Yeah,
doesn't really have much ability to adjust in him at all.
Yep. Which makes this kind of fascinating, because there's nothing to say that Ricardo Hamosh can't go out there and spinning back elbow Julian Erosa.
Yeah, or head kick him, or just hit him with a straight right and just flatten him right away.
And I will honestly say, too, I kind of feel like Erosa's confidence is looking rattled.
Hmm.
I did not like at all the way he looked against Alex Caceres.
Yeah.
Like, he did not take a fight to Caceres at all. He let Caceres just open up and have open space, which is like the whole way to lose to Alex Caceres.
Yeah.
And then Padilla, you know, also a fighter who can be that's probably more a problem where Erosa doesn't have a range game to speak of.
Yeah, he's just got to walk into a puncher's wheelhouse.
Yeah. But yeah, either way,
even the Caceres one, I might just think there's certain styles that Julian Erosa really has, like, one really good way of fighting, which is to barrel into close range.
Yeah.
And hit you with shots and drag you into the clinch and wear you out and just put a hellacious pace on you. And I mean, is there anybody who fights like Alex Caceres that he has beaten before? Who just like doesn't let him get into the pocket?
I mean, yeah, let's see. I mean,
lost to Julio Arce.
Yeah. Devontae Smith.
Yeah, I think this is also just a level of
Jamal footwork. Emmers, I would say, is a guy who actually can be pretty decent at that. And he beat Emmers, but...
Yeah. I just think that's another way to outthink Erosa. Like, you can nail him really hard early, but also, like, as aggressive as he is, he's not really technically a fantastic pressure fighter, which is why guys like Charles Rodin and... Sean Woodson, despite being really good kickboxers, technically speaking, they paid for their tendency to just let somebody corner them.
Yeah.
But if you don't do that, then I think Erosa is going to have a hard time tracking you down. He's not very fast. He's not super quick on his feet. And technically his cage cutting footwork isn't really all that polished. He just marches after you.
But Hamosh might let him.
Hamosh cannot be relied upon. That's the thing. I think this feels very much a 50-50. Like,
I am going to pick Hamosh because I have worries that Erosa is just like maybe that run of success is done, and if he's lost the if he's losing the real bite down on it ifness. Of his game, I'm a little concerned that might be the case, and I am going to weigh that as my tipping point. And what I see is otherwise being could easily be a two true outcome fight where Erosa either gets finished immediately or walks Hamosh down for the whole fight and ends up beating him.
Yeah, I'll take Erosa. Not that I don't think that's not a perfectly logical call. This feels like very 50-50 to me.
Yeah.
Erosa is just super vulnerable early, and Hamosh is fast and hits hard. But also, like, once Charles Jourdain started chasing Hamosh, yes, he got in on takedowns. He also dove into guillotines. Erosa, by the way, has a great front headlock submission chain. And I think Hamosh is definitely ripe for bullying.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't really have all of the like positional subtleties of boxing to keep you out of his wheelhouse if you're determined to get there. He does not have.
And Nurmagomedov just gave him hell by being willing to sit down on some big strikes and show him some different looks.
Yep.
You know,
I think this looks like a classic Erosa fight, and that the first round is going to be very difficult, and very likely he will not make it out of that round.
Yep.
But if he does, I think Hamosh is going to be feeling a lot more pressure and pace than he really is comfortable with in any fight.
Yep.
Not that Hamosh just like crumbles outright. You know, he fought his ass off against Takugov too.
Yeah, he did. You have to keep bringing the fight to him. It's just that when you do, you can find him making the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah.
Or occasionally just getting frozen up.
Yeah. And Erosa's actually, when he is feeling the initiative and has his pressure is building, he is actually really good at drawing those mistakes out and actually finishing you as a punishment for them. Like, I really do think... I wouldn't be that surprised if we get an Erosa, Darce, or guillotine in round 3 of this fight if it goes that far.
Yeah.
Because he's going to make Hamosh want to shoot on him.
I can see it. So,
once again, looks like a fun matchup.
Yep. Erosa opened at plus 144. He's currently at plus 137. And Hamosh opened at minus 185, currently minus 152. Honestly, should just be kind of a coin flip. They're pretty close. Odds are pretty close anyway, but
yep.
I would not trust either of these men to perform consistently enough to be like, oh, yeah, he's got this.
No. Maybe all inside right. The distance is a decent bet. Is there a prop for that available?
Let's see. Rosa Hamosh. Let's see. Where is the props? Oh, there they are. Fight ends under 2.5 rounds is minus 160. Inside the distance, we've got Erosa inside the distance is plus 225. Hamosh inside the distance plus 130. I don't think we have otherwise. You just have to do the under 2.5 rounds.
I mean, that's basically a bet on a finish.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem crazy to me. Hamosh has been finished in 3 of his UFC fights, and Erosa has been finished in all but 3 of his 11 losses.
Yeah.
So, and both guys are decent finishers as well. So, I think it's gonna turn violent, this one.
Mm-hmm. All right, that brings us to a bantamweight bout: Miles Johns, Cody Gibson.
This just feels rude to Cody Gibson, doesn't it?
It does.
I don't know that there are a lot of forgiving matchups. Cody Gibson, I feel bad saying it because he's a very cool guy. He's like one of the few like pretty like level-headed, pretty intelligent MMA fighters on social media.
A tragedy considering his best known moment.
Yes. Was do you know who I am?
Google me, bitch.
Google me, bitch. That's so good. He really should have that on like his walkout t-shirt or something. Google me, bitch, is too good. But Cody Gibson, I think a pretty cool guy and really scrappy fighter. Yep. And just not a good athlete.
Yeah.
He's been cursed by the gods to be a hardworking spirit and a pretty normal human body.
It's unfortunate too, because you can even see like in his fights against Miles John or Brad Katona and Ray Borg.
Yeah, yeah.
He is clearly, you know, he looks real fit. He's mm-hmm. training real hard. He's in good shape. But the cost of the fight he wants to have also wears him out. Like he's not a good enough athlete in a lot of ways to carry off the kind of fight that he would need to have and wants to have to win.
Yeah. Cause the thing is stylistically, he is basically a brawler. Like,
yeah, he has learned that if you're not going to be a great athlete, what you actually have to do is not avoid damage. You have to do the Billy Quarantillo thing and push people, get people into a fight where heart can mean more than athleticism.
Yeah. You know, like against a guy like Brad Katona, he was like just this close to pulling it off.
Yep.
And but Brad Katona has kind of a dysfunctional game.
Yes.
However, one quality he definitely has is he really does not lose easily.
No.
Brad Katona is certainly a fighter who answers the call when he's pushed. And he did it. And yep. Just had a little bit better boxing technique, a little better wrestling technique, and a whole lot more natural athletic talent.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is that, like I say, I think, you know, Gibson, you see a lot. He starts really well in his fights, in a lot of his fights, where you're like, man, this guy's out there. He's putting it on people. He looks,
yep.
He looks slick. He looks fast. He looks determined. But doing that, pushing that pace wears him out. I mean, it reminds me a bit of like Angela Hill.
Yeah, yes.
For a lot of the years of her career where she would try to have this like that she'd try to be doing the Dominic Cruz thing and have this like bouncy in and out footwork and all this movement and all this stuff. And then by like round 2, round 3, she'd just be flat footed and slogging because she just doesn't have even the natural cardio and, you know, dynamic ability to maintain that, because it takes athleticism just to do that kind of stuff too, you know?
Yeah. There's definitely a guys like Marab. You're going to look at guys like that and say that there is no innate, that cardio cannot itself be an athletic talent to some extent. It's probably the one you can improve the most just by working on it.
But there are limits. Absolutely. You know,
As there are with anything when you're talking about talent or attributes.
Yeah.
And Miles Johns not only has way more innate athletic talent, he's also got steroids, which robbed him of his last win.
Was it steroids?
I'm pretty sure it was Turinabol or something like that. Yeah, it was.
Okay.
After he beat Dan Argueta, he was suspended for testing positive for the anabolic steroid Turinabol. Now he's back. And Miles Johns just has like the most pure athlete game too.
I mean, he's straight out of 2009.
He really is. He's a very much a throwback wrestle boxer, which is to say that the wrestling is not actually good, but if you're worried about the takedowns, you're going to feel the power in his hands.
Mm-hmm.
Really like, despite the athleticism, he comes across as quite a sluggish puncher.
Mm-hmm.
But he is like fully willing to completely overextend and lunge after you to land that right hand. And with good reason, because anytime he's leaning forward, you're going to be worried about the takedown. And if it hits you, it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
And he's just really strong. And I kind of don't know how much of this is artificial or how much that even matters anymore with the current drug testing regime, but seems to have excellent conditioning. Mm-hmm. Certainly against Argueta, that was a really torrid pace in that fight. And I think it was largely his ability to stay consistent that allowed him to win. Allowed him to win at first.
Yep.
Until it was overturned. And he just looks like a... It just seems like a fight perfectly designed to show how important athletic talent is, because if that kind of thing didn't matter, Cody Gibson would absolutely just run house on Miles Johns.
Yep.
Because he's just got a way more... His game just makes a lot more sort of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But he's going to end up trading punches with a guy who hits way harder. He's going to end up having to fight off takedowns from a guy who's, yes, much smaller, but stronger, faster, and technically a superior wrestler as well.
Yeah, I mean, you do have to go back to that Ray Borg fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
For Cody Gibson, a guy who should be a flyweight, faster, and more dynamic than Johns, to be sure. But, like, you know, it was pretty even for a little while. Gibson looked good and was busy. And then he just got plugged really hard. And then his cardio started to fail him and he started getting out wrestled. And that was it. You know, that was the rest of the fight.
Yeah. It's just hard to see a path for Cody Gibson that doesn't involve him just like pitting his limited physicality against Miles Johns's obviously much better physicality.
Yeah, because Stu, like we were saying, the whole way that Cody Gibson fights as a not that athletic guy is to go out there and, you know, get physical with people to try and make it so that it's not to get out of people's way and try. He's not doing the Trey Ogden thing.
Yeah,
where he's doing the game of somebody who knows that. They're hoping if they can pour on enough volume and enough aggression, you will quit before the fight, before you get a chance to figure out you're stronger or faster. Yep. So, and there's, you know, it's reasonable. It is a fight. It is a style that many others have used, but there's also a reason that Gibson is 19-9 with it over his career. All right. Odds on the fight. Johns is the favorite, not by a lot. Opened at minus 105, currently minus 141. Gibson opened at minus 105, jumped up to plus 107, currently plus 127. So his odds getting a little wider as they go. They could maybe get a little wider, but, you know, Johns is certainly not, like, unbeatable with his funky old man game.
No, he's a very clunky fighter.
Yeah.
For all his athleticism, and it hasn't exactly translated into coordinated striking.
Yeah, or easy dominance over anybody. He always has a hard fight.
Pretty much, yep. And he's going to have a hard one here for as long as it lasts. But I just think he's going to be like ultimately like running into a wall for poor Cody Gibson.
That brings us to a featherweight bout. Stephen Wynn against Jarno Ahrens. And this is not a bad fight. It's two fighters who, to me at the moment, seem a bit like they have a fatal flaw that is hard to iron out.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that both of them like to watch their work.
Mm-hmm.
Ahrens is much more of a, like, I pick a strike from my bag of... He's a bit more on the Lando Venata side of things. Where it's like, I pick a strike from my bag of tricks, and then I jump in to throw it, regardless of what's going to happen. And then I kind of stop, or it can be timed as I do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I guess you could also say that that's sort of like the... what's his name? Joaquin Buckley kind of problem, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know? He's a bit on that flavor. And when he just has pauses built all over his game, he wants, ideally, to be a counter combination striker. But his first reaction when somebody comes in after him is to shield with a high guard. So you'll see like an opponent get like three or four strikes before Wynn gets his counter combination going. And he punches well on that counter. And if he doesn't go to the high guard, then he'll often instantly answer with like a jab.
Mm-hmm.
But when he does, he gives people a chance to just fire some shots at him. And when he goes first, he's usually just sort of throwing something out to then initiate that counter combination. So he'll jump in with a 1-2 and then set himself to defend so that he can slip it and come back. But once again, with the defense, it's often just kind of a high guard and let a couple strikes land before he answers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a lot of room around the work Wynn is doing for him to get hit. And, you know, like I'm not that shocked that he got flying knee KO'd by Alon Cruz, a pretty like weakened wild fighter. All things considered, pretty poorly put together fighter, but who liked to go and, you know, try crazy stuff because he just Wynn's going to give you a chance to surprise him, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Which could be a big problem against Ahrens because, like I say, Ahrens is very much a, like, I want to pick something fun out of my bag of tricks fighter as well. Unfortunately, he's also not a fighter really capable of controlling anything at all. He's not a distance fighter, and he's a willing guard puller. And he will just sort of let his opponent dictate. So it's a hard fight to call because both men just have, like I say, some big obvious flaws that I don't really know who's are going to show up worse. I think I'm going to take Wynn just because I feel like he makes fewer fatal errors, and he is good at taking advantage of the gaps other people leave. He will fill, when he counters, he will counter in combination, and he will go after somebody if he starts tagging and hurting them. Whereas Aaron's is really just sort of like always resetting himself to go try to do something big again. But if Wynn just gets caught out, like letting his opponent go, have the first move, then I won't be shocked.
Yeah, I'm kind of inclined to side with you. In Nguyen's game, I can actually see the sort of beginnings of a pretty decent boxing approach.
Yeah. If he could just have better footwork and upper body movement. Like right now, he's kind of doing... I was going to say he's kind of doing like a Sean Strickland thing almost. He's not as singularly jab dependent as Strickland, and he is much more willing to fire heavy combinations, but there's also just sort of a rigid uprightness to him.
Yeah.
And overwillingness to just sort of cover that I don't like.
That's really the thing is, I think this is what I mean. Like I can actually see like the jab and pivot as a reset is sort of, he's been trained to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't yet seem to have the confidence that that is actually going to work to protect him.
Yeah.
So he will step in and jab and get off to an angle. Sometimes he'll double and triple the jab. And I always like to see a fighter doing that. But then he sort of is, I mean, I think it's a thing a lot of young and inexperienced fighters have because it's a tendency all fighters have, which is to take turns.
Mm-hmm.
You go, I go. And you, like, over time, you learn to overcome that. You learn to be ready to interrupt the opponent to take advantage of their tendency to take turns. Like, that's what Sean O'Malley did with Chito Vera. One of many things he did, but every time he would strike Chito early and he would just see Chito like gearing up to come forward, is like, here's a jab, here's an oblique kick, just like resetting with a stop to interrupt. And so Chito just never got to take his turn, which meant he couldn't build any momentum at all.
Yeah.
And Nguyen doesn't look like it's almost like he makes the right move, but then he insists on you having your turn.
Mm-hmm.
Because he just sort of shells up and steps back and like lets you throw until you're done, and then he goes back to work. But I think the right moves are there. He just doesn't.
Yeah,
it looks like a problem of experience to me, really.
This is my big note of caution on him.
Yeah,
is he is 30, and he's been a pro for 8 years. He's just not been fighting much because he's been waiting exclusively for a UFC call. So. Like, he's only been fighting on the Contender Series for the past few years.
I mean, that still only amounts to 2 fights.
Yeah, well, and one in 2019 as well.
Oh, shit, that too. Yeah, he just doesn't fight very often.
He got 5 wins and got to the Contender Series, lost, and has just been waiting for callback ever since. They even talked about it on the Contender Series. And he's even been an amateur since 2011.
I don't know what else might be going on and how maybe this wasn't feasible, but he probably really would have benefited from spending some of that time just taking fights and getting rounds and in front of an audience.
Yeah. Cause at 30 and with 13 years combined of MMA experience, part of me, like, I definitely feel like, yeah, he's got a game. He's got a good young man's game that could be built on.
Yeah.
But I also just wonder if it's actually at this point his finished product, and it might be good enough to beat Jarno Ahrens.
Yeah,
but
that could be the case. I won't bet on that yet, but that certainly is something to keep in mind.
Yeah,
it's just a weird career. I mean,
it is. It is
8 years, but only, what is it? 9 fights.
10 fights. 10 fights.
10 fights.
Yeah.
It's just a really slow schedule.
seems I would probably bet that more or that there are, you know, maybe more fighters now who are just see like that the UFC signs just about everybody. And so they are just sort of holding on hope of like, oh, I got a couple wins. I should just stop fighting and wait for the UFC to come.
Yeah, except that you should also know as part of that, that the UFC is happy to just make you apex filler forever.
Yep.
And that you'd still be better served preparing yourself to like make a statement when you get to the UFC and then advance.
Yeah. A lot of the guys who have done the best to climb the quickest and make the biggest statements in the UFC have been guys who came in with a ton of experience and were just already ready from day one.
Yeah.
To get climb up into the top 10 or top 15.
Yep.
You know, your Israel Adesanya's, your Alex Pereira's.
Yep.
You're those kinds of guys. Your Yuri Prochazka's.
Yep. So, but I still feel like I'm going to pick him over Aarons.
He's got a very old school Jackson Wink feel to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He doesn't just watch his work. He like doesn't set up his work.
No, yeah.
It's just kind of a grab bag fighter. And, you know, you could do worse than to just like sort of rely on a nice tight high guard.
Yeah.
Against a guy who's probably just going to wing something at you and then not follow it up.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy who can also, because Nguyen does have the ability to do this, can always be countered down the middle with a straight shot.
Yep.
Always. No matter what he's throwing. So, yeah, I'm going to pick Nguyen, but yeah, a well-placed word of caution on his, maybe the limits of his ability to
improve. Yeah, it might be that what we're seeing here is just going to be the guy he is, and that will come with some pretty severe limitation tests at featherweight as he moves forward in the division.
Yeah.
Nguyen opened at minus 222, is currently minus 175. Aarons opened at plus 169, is currently plus 155. That seems fine. Montserrat Rendon, Daria Zeleznyakova. There we go.
I think that was pretty good. I'm not even going to mock you for that one. Zeleznyakova.
Daria Zeleznyakova.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Do you know any Daria references? We can just sort of say that instead. I didn't watch that show.
Sick Sad World.
There you go.
Yeah. Daria Sick Sad World Zeleznyakova.
That's the catchphrase. No wonder I didn't watch that show.
Show on it.
Oh, okay.
That they would watch on Daria, which is an excellent use of the trope that if you are going to put a TV show or a movie in your TV show or movie, yeah, it should always be weirder than your TV show or movie.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. You got your
RoboCop is the easy.
You got Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
You got, yeah, always just have like a goofy, hammier, stupider show than your show.
Yeah.
30 Rock. The whole show is about a show that's worse than the show.
Exactly. That is this is the rule. Because if it's a normal show on your show, then it breaks the reality of it because your show is already going to be a heightened reality. And in a heightened reality, like a TV show and movies are always heightened reality. So if you don't have heightened reality from that,
yeah,
in that TV show or movie, then it's like, well, this isn't real.
The little fake noir movie in Home Alone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's got to be something weirder. So anyway,
I did not watch Daria.
It's worth it. But
you say so. Yeah, I don't know, but I mean, we made a good call, if I recall correctly, with Montserrat Rendon.
Yeah, she's slow-footed, not an athlete, but is very consistent in a way that Tamira Vidal absolutely just was not.
Yeah, we sort of took a chance on her against somebody who appears to be a pretty markedly better athlete, and her ability to just sort of keep slowly pressing forward, pop jabs out there, lumber into the clinch,
yeah,
and wear it all out. But boy, rewatching it, I mean, Rendon is very slow.
very slow.
She's not just foot slow. Her right hand is like almost comically slow.
Continental drift.
Yeah. Yeah. She got a tectonic right hand.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because, like, stylistically, I don't think she's that different from Zheleznyakova.
No.
But Zheleznyakova looks much faster.
Yeah.
Like, just a much fiercer. And as a result, she just feels a lot more effective with her aggression.
Yeah. She I think, can be stuck in positions where she will just totally lose.
Yeah.
More so than Rendon.
Yeah, yeah. Rendon's more solid in that way.
Yeah. Zheleznyakova, her only loss, and it is a pretty mediocre stoppage, but her only loss was her absolutely beating Melissa Mullins.
Melissa Tomei Mullins.
Yeah. Melissa Tomei Mullins' ass for around for 4 minutes and 40 seconds or so, and then getting taken down and beat up enough in the like next 15 seconds that the ref was like, oh no, I got to stop this. And she wasn't fighting back. She didn't know what to do. You can't really blame the ref for that. But it was also just one of those things of like, if you let it go one more second, they would have restarted and I would have no.
Maybe a bit of a women's stoppage.
It felt that way.
We know that's a thing. Referees.
The shots weren't so heavy that it was like, oh, she's just out of it now. Yeah. She even, when the ref pulled her off, she got up and thought that she was still like, the fight was still going.
Yeah.
You know, not, and it wasn't like, oh, was I think, yeah, no, but just because she was still fresh.
Yeah.
So
that's definitely a way this could go down favorably for Rendon is these two are definitely going to end up in a lot of clinches.
Mm-hmm.
They both fight in a really like head forward position. And they, in fact, particularly Zheleznyakova tends to really commit and step in with her strikes. Like, I think she wants the clinch. She likes she likes to knee people there. That's certainly an area where Rendon just being more sort of positionally solid and possibly a little stronger. I mean, Rendon's pretty big.
Yeah. Zheleznyakova is actually bigger, but Rendon is like solidly,
very solidly built. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a way for Rendon to just get to a good position and, like she did against Vidal, just sit there and do just enough work to not get stood up. And if Zheleznyakova doesn't know how to escape, that's certainly a way to lose a fight.
Yep.
But I think I'm going to take Zheleznyakova.
No, yeah. You have
she's
to.
She's much sharper, much faster. Rendon is just unbelievably sluggish on the feet.
Yeah.
And this isn't Vidal. Like, this isn't just a speed advantage. Like, Zheleznyakova actually knows how to throw her jab. She knows how to throw some combinations. Yeah. She's a hard, fast kicker.
Vidal fooled people with a jump knee into thinking that she actually knew how to strike, but she didn't at all.
Yeah, she's got no real game. She's
just kind of dynamic.
Yeah.
Kind of.
And that dynamism is super limited by her, for example, not knowing how to get into her effective range.
Yeah.
Like, you really got to screw up to get punished by that kind of dynamism. Zheleznyakova will take a fight to Rendon and will put a pace on her as long as she's allowed.
Yeah. So. This is a fight that could very easily, in a couple of ways, look so one-sided that, like, it didn't seem worth making.
Yeah.
Either, you know, with Zheleznyakova just going out and, like, hurting Rendon with the first couple of strikes she throws because it's so much faster than what Rendon can manage and putting her away, or with Rendon like clinching her up and taking her down and then just Zheleznyakova having so little idea what to do off her back that the ref has to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I got to pick Zheleznyakova in that. I don't think Rendon is any sort of expert takedown artist that is going to overly pursue that. She wants to stand and strike.
Yep.
You know?
It's just that there are going to be clinches. Like,
yes, there will.
Either of them are good enough at actually keeping their own effective range to not just crash into each other. That's Rendon's way into sort of accidentally off wrestling her.
Yep. Montserrat Rendon opened at +116. He's currently at +183. Daria Zeleznikova opened at -149. Is currently at -207.
You know, I was intimidated by it at first, but I've actually had a lot of fun saying Zeleznikova.
Yeah. Once you get it down, once you find the rhythm of it.
It's a fun name.
Yep. All right. That brings us to a men's flyweight bout. Igor, I guess. I don't know. What do the Brazilians do with the Igors?
It's almost certainly Igor.
Igor Severino against Andre Lima. And a couple of decent, if slightly raw, flyweight prospects, I feel like.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel more like flyweights than a lot of the other guys we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, one of whom was Steve Ursig, who's turned out to be a pretty damn good boxer by
flyweight standards. Yeah, no kidding. So both guys kind of have the same game that they've come to for different reasons. Severino is a former jungle fight champ who very much leans on his power and willingness to wade forward, does not fight at a flyweight pace, but hits hard and can be tough and just hang in on people and make them have to deal with him. And Lima tends to fight at a pretty slow pace and hit hard and likes to pressure, but does it with a kickboxing background that pretty clearly shows itself whenever he gets the chance and is very much just taking his time to find his shots. It's not I'm just looking to wind up on one big shot and keep you moving backwards. He uses the pressure to force opponents to try to throw something to push him back so that he can come back with something much slicker. And that could make this a difficult fight to call. My sounds gut.
Dicey.
Yeah. My gut says that I should go with Lima because his footwork is much better. He's much better practiced in the kind of fight he wants. But I'm also, you know, I do wonder if he's not worse set up for the sort of rigors of an MMA fight if Severino can pull the fight into other areas. If he can stall him in the clinch or take him down or things like that, Severino might be more likely to just create more out of different opportunities, where I think Lima really has one area that he wants to keep the fight at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always something to be a little nervous of. But
to me, it's a really big question who's actually going to be, which of these guys actually insists on the pressure.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like Severino.
He might.
He's just more of a brute.
Yeah, he is more of a brute. That is true. He might be the one who insists on the pressure.
I think he's just going to throw his guard up and march Lima down. And I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen enough of Lima to have a really good idea of how his game functions when he's just not allowed to do the sort of calculated pressure thing.
Mm-hmm.
My instinct is probably doesn't work as good.
It's usually how it goes.
Uh-huh.
But the thing with Severino is that he doesn't put a lot out there. And it's not like he's a counter fighter either.
No.
He's really just walking you down and walking into things and then picking a chance to just throw something big and hope that like, you know, use his power to make you start crumbling a little.
Yeah. And at least when he's got his pressure, Lima is a much sharper striker.
Much sharper.
He is far more accurate. I mean, he doesn't throw a lot of combinations, but he's a really accurate pot shotter. I mean, he uses that pressure to get you to like open yourself up, square yourself up. He can walk you into strikes. Yeah, I just don't know. There's this lingering feeling that Severino is just going to march into him, and that might allow Severino's wrestling to start working.
Yep.
And, you know, like, there were some close calls in Lima's Contender Series fight with the wrestling, but like I said, like, the entire fight was just him getting to walk forward at will.
Yeah.
Pretty much. I'll take Lima as well. One thing I really do like about Lima's game is that if you are going to try to lean on wrestling against him, he seems to be really good at punishing takedown attempts.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are true flyweights, I think. They have the potential. They need to, like a lot of good flyweights who are not, you know, who are just getting to the UFC, they have not had to adjust to the meta.
Yeah.
Being like, you've got to be active. You know, we saw this with Manel Kopp. We've seen this just with a bunch of guys. Mateusz Nicolau.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just it's a very common thing where a lot of guys come to the UFC and they're just kind of very Zalgiris Dzhumagulov had this problem a lot. Tyson Nam.
Yep.
And they have to learn over time that, like, no, you're going to fight a bunch of dudes who throw like three times as much as you. But yeah, in a fight where both guys have that problem, I'm just willing to go with, like, he just seems like he's a better schooled, more technical fighter.
Yeah, he's just a calmer, more precise striker. And
yeah,
not only is the defensive wrestling and the scrambling very good, but what I mean by punishing is, like,
yeah,
this dude will rack you with a savage knee.
Yeah.
After he's finished, this is the important thing. After he's finished defending the takedown.
Yes.
Is it going to let you keep chaining shit together? He's going to stuff it, and then he's going to, like, side clinch you, frame you off, and smack you with a knee.
Yeah.
I just like the look of Lima's technique better, but this should be a pretty fun fight. I think both these guys have potential, and they're both quite young.
Yeah.
Particularly Severino. He's, what, 20 years old?
Yeah, he's 20. Yeah.
He's a baby.
And Lima is only 25.
Yeah, so both young.
Odds on the bout.
Good to have more flyweights. One of these guys is, thanks to this prominent booking, one of these guys is sure to be in a title fight next.
That's right. Igor Da Silva opened at plus 142, is currently plus 144. So not a lot of change on that line. Andre Lima opened at minus 174, is currently at minus 176. All right. That brings us to a heavyweight fight. Muhammad Usman, Mick Parkin.
That's right, baby. First of all, here's a heavyweight fight that could have been placed more prominently. Come on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, why isn't this the main event?
I am joking, but also, why would you bury Muhammad Usman? This guy is a blast.
He is pure entertainment.
Why would you bury him down in the curtain jerker fight? I don't know.
Probably just because you thought that he was actually rocks and that you were looking to shore up a foundation.
Yeah, they sort of put him there to, like, keep the apex from blowing away.
Yeah, yeah.
The rocks around the tent stakes.
You know? Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, this is a heavyweight fight.
Yep.
In fact, it's better than a standard heavyweight fight.
It might honestly be better than Carl Williams, Justin Taffa.
As a matchup, it's more interesting. I'm not sure either of these guys is a better wrestler than Carl Williams.
No, sure.
But like, that one feels super obvious how it's going to go down.
Yeah.
This is one where Muhammad Usman is a wrestler who is, you know, honestly quite rapidly developing his boxing game. He's still really awkward and weird, but he really is, like, figuring out how his jab informs his footwork.
Yep.
And seems to have really great cardio for a heavyweight because he does a lot of moving and a lot of big dramatic actions and does not slow down that much. But he's in there against Mick Parkin, who also can kind of wrestle.
Yeah.
You know? a much grimier, grosser version of wrestling. But Mick Parkin can hit single legs. He'll drag people to the ground. He's a grimy fighter.
And you know, he's built the whole rest of his game around working behind a jab.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't necessarily do it really well, but he does it.
It's better than what are these other heavyweights are doing.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, I think this might actually be like a pretty even fight. Where both guys can kind of counter each other's A games. That might, for all I know, that may mean it's going to look like absolute shit.
Yeah, it could really just be three rounds of I jab, you jab, I jab, you jab.
I go for takedown, you defend.
You go for takedown, I defend.
We both gasp for breath, you jab, I jab.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have faith in Muhammad Usman's rapidly developing boxing game to carry him through here. He, as I said, like half the shit he was doing against Jake Collier really should not have worked. Mm-hmm. He was like getting out of range by like switching stance while punches were coming at him. And like ducking down, like kissing his own knees before popping back up with a counter. These super big movements. He didn't know how to actually pivot most of the time. He was like changing angles by dropping back out of his stance. I never liked that.
Mm-hmm.
But the ideas were there.
Yeah.
And that accounts for a lot at heavyweight. Most guys don't have ideas. True. You know, they barely have thoughts.
When you're that big, it takes a lot for the synapses to connect.
Yeah, you know? There's just not enough blood. And the distance between the synapses, mm-hmm. it's like a 3-hour drive.
Yep.
Yeah. But I think that Usman can probably outlast Parkin on the feet and can probably make him do a lot more moving than he would like. And is probably going to at least double up on him with like jab volume. And that's why I'm going to pick him.
Yeah, I'm going to take Parkin. I think that this is I think he's just too consistent for Usman to just find what, you know, some weird stuff to get him into this fight. I think Usman does well when he can convince an opponent that like actually their way of fighting just doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Parkin is a guy who's got enough confidence still and enough singular tools he can go to that he is not going to feel that way about it, you know? So, like, yeah, it just to me, I think Parkin can, like, Jake Collier, you know, he landed the same amount of shots as Usman over that fight.
Oh, it was a razor close fight.
It was a razor close fight.
Yeah.
But Collier also just got like, you know, he sort of had his confidence sapped as it went on.
Yeah, he got tired and he's used to wearing people out. And Usman, I think very much to his credit, did so much more work than Collier really off the back foot and just lasted longer.
Yeah, and to me, Parkin just seems like he's a guy who is more used to winning and controlling people and less used to himself to getting worn out. So I think
that's kind of why I think he's going to be flabbergasted.
It might be, but I kind of feel like the guys that Muhammad Usman has been beating are guys that do just that they already know that they crumble under pressure.
Sure. Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. I just think Usman is weird and annoying to fight.
He definitely is that.
You get your front foot, you get the pressure you think you want, and he just keeps poking you. And then, like, it's just not that easy to track down.
Mm-hmm.
He's not easy to hurt. And I don't know. I think that Parkin's striking really is like nothing to write home about at all. And
no, I don't think it is either. I just think I guess I kind of feel like this is a. I feel like Jamal Pogues is kind of that same kind of fight to me.
Okay.
Where he's just another dude that's just really annoying to fight. And it wasn't a pretty fight for Parkin, but he just did enough to scrape it by.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah.
You are basically picking him to out wrestle Usman, right?
No, I don't think so. I think he could easily just go out and like out jab and clinch and.
I don't see that happening.
No, because like. You know.
I know it looks goofy. I know it looks goofy and it shouldn't work, but I just don't think Parkins. I think the striking is just a bridge to his wrestling.
I don't think so. I mean, I think it can be, but I don't know.
We'll see.
We'll see.
It's a goofy enough fight to have my interest.
I think he could. I think he could trap Usman on the cage for short bouts of time that would allow him to go back to, you know, basically like jab and reset, even if he doesn't get to his wrestling game. Basically.
I think you will be surprised once again by Mr. Moonboots, Muhammad Usman.
Okay. I am willing. Trust me.
You're willing to believe.
Usman opened at plus 137. He's currently plus 127. Parkin is opened at minus 152. Is currently at minus 141. All right. On that note, we're going to wrap things up. We don't have time for some bonus content this week. I know some people are always like, why don't you guys just take whatever time you need and produce as much as we want and all that? Who's rushing you and all that? I am rushing us. I don't have enough time to fill my whole day just doing this show. It's already like 3 hours long every week. Yeah. I am not Joe Rogan here. So on that note, you can find me on Twitter at TheZaneSimon. You can find Connor on Twitter at BoxingBush. You can find our podcasts over on the MMA Draw Substack for now. That may change, although it may not. We are currently weighing our options, so I don't want anyone to just expect that we're going to make some big shift here immediately. So.
Check out my Substack, facepunching.substack.com. I have a Rose Namajunas boxing breakdown coming out this week.
And check out my Substack, zanesimon.substack.com, where I have daily editorial content. Love to see it. Hate to see it. MMA business roundup, movie talk, live threads for events, and all that and more. So check that out.
To check out mine first.
No, check out mine first.
I'll give you a kiss.
I will not give you a kiss.
I will whore myself. I have no shame, no pride.
All right. Adios, everyone.